So, Vivian, absolute pleasure to have you today. Really appreciate you taking the trip down to the baths.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're not dunking today. We're not swimming. There's no water involved unless I burn my eyes out, which is probably highly likely. To be honest, this is the sort of conversation we're going into. I just have no idea where to start.
Where's it gonna go?
I usually do like all kind of first memory sort of stuff. Maybe we'll get into that at some point. But a kind of interesting little nugget or jumping off point maybe could be tell me about Dolly the sheep, because this is something I haven't thought about or heard of since I was probably in school, and I was fascinated by everything around that world. So how did you get involved in that?
So I grew up in a tiny wee village in Scotland called Roslyn, and it's nestled in the countryside just outside Edinburgh, about maybe 10 miles south of Edinburgh. And there's an institute there called the Roslyn Institute. And I'd been there for years, and it was this like really mysterious, like nobody kind of knew what went on. It was like an X-Files kind of place.
I'm already picturing like how I would picture Wuhan, you know what I mean?
That's
like
it.
The lab in Wuhan.
And we used to look through the woods, like, I wonder what goes on in there. So I had quite a difficult childhood. There was lots of different things going on. And there was a job came up for an experimental worker in molecular biology and immunology, which sounded pretty cool. This was in 1996.
Unreal.
And I went for the job. And the woman who I was going to be working with was a friend of the family. So she knew our family. She kind of knew a bit of my background.
Yeah.
And when it came to interview people, she apparently had said to the interview panel, look, if you bring someone in who has experience of this job, they are going to come with expectations from previous laboratories, they're going to come with ideas, they're going to come with all these things. We have this place running as a really tight ship, and we'd like to keep it like that. One of the applicants, I personally know her, and you know, she has a wee boy, and you know, she's not had the best start in life, and she would, you know, she lives locally, she would be so good for the job. So based on that, I ended up getting the job.
Wow.
So I was working alongside Dr. Ian Wilmot. I was working alongside John Clark and the whole team that was there. And I never really knew everything that was kind of going on, but I knew there was this big thing happening. And the big thing was Dolly the sheep. So she was the first cloned sheep using stem cell.
Wow.
She wasn't the first attempt. She certainly wasn't. But yeah, and then in, I think it was like the July 1996, I started work. And I think I started there in about the March, February or March. And but a funny story, because the funniest thing, there was people protesting, as you can imagine.
Sure, right?
But the best protesters were the protesters for free love, who were saying, if we start using stem cell research, then we're going to, like, we're not going to have any use for procreation. So people are, so we had naked people turn up, right, who were running around the woods, and who the police were like, we were sitting in our office watching them, and we're like, is that naked people in the trees? But with the placards,
brilliant,
like, free love, free love. And I was just like, only in Roslyn. But yeah, she was a world phenomenon. It was a sensation.
Yeah. It's even really interesting to hear you talk about, like, that's what people were really worried about or protesting about then. Maybe I'm just totally disconnected, but like, I'm just thinking about that now. But like, I think people wouldn't bat an eyelid now. You know what I mean? Like, things have changed so much about,
absolutely,
like, what we're really worried about or concerned about. So yeah, it's an interesting little kind of historical artifact at this point, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it was funny because I was like, when I was just thinking about this the other day there, and I was like, 1996. It's like 25, 26 years ago.
Don't want to scare you. Born 95.
Oh, wow. You're only one.
I was one when Dolly part two came around, yeah. What happened? Like, so at the end of the day, there was two sheep, and they were both, did they both live? Like, they were living around walking?
So it was a black-faced ewe.
Wow.
And they used the stem cells, and I'm not very sure actually on what they've done. My background is not in science. But they created, so from the stem cell, they replanted back in to the mother, and then she had Dolly, who was an exact clone of the mother.
Man.
But then Dolly went on and had her own sheep, well, her own lambs.
Yeah.
But I always remember when, because I worked there, I could take the kids down to have a wee look and go down and see her. And as I say, as well as the protests for Free Love, they were just the best ones. But there was other people protesting about, you know, lots of different things. And I remember it being quite a scary time for the village, actually, because and because I worked there and lived there, I was then told that I wasn't allowed to take my car down because people were taking the registration plates, and because I lived so close.
Wow.
So, and we were told to take different routes to work and back home. So there was lots of things. I remember it being quite, you know, there was quite a lot of you know, security updates and things like that as well. But yeah, it's just, it's mad that it's that length of time ago. And as you say, science has moved on. But I always remember also, as you walked in, they had this big like, you know, like a big board thing.
Yeah.
And it was a hermaphrodite chicken. And they had like one half male and one half female. And the one half female was like really soft coated and quite a smaller foot. Uh-huh. And the other half was really rough coated and this great big hawk-like foot.
Crazy.
But I was always fascinated with science. I was all, science has always really, it's always just caught my imagination. Do you know anything to do with science? And I'm like, oh. It takes me off into wee worlds inside my own head that,
that's awesome.
You know, where anything can happen.
Yeah, so cool. I mean, and I think especially growing up in like sleepy Roslyn, you know, it's amazing to see like how the mind can wander and the things your mind can attach on to.
And, you know, Roslyn, there's two ley lines in Roslyn. There's a ley line that goes across the earth that way and there's a ley line that goes across the earth that way, and they meet right in the, at the, there's a crossroads at the top of the village. Mm-hmm. And you can go, and then you go down to the Roslyn Chapel, which featured in the Da Vinci Code. So they reckon all the
Roslyn.
Roslyn's just a great wee village.
I mean, forget Belfast, best of Roslyn, let's go. The history's crazy.
And there's, so they reckon all the holy relics, like the Holy Grail, like everything, had been taken from the Last Supper and had been taken out to Roslyn, had been hidden under there, and like all these different things. There's all these huge stories. And they excavated in round about the same time, actually.
Oh,
probably
yeah?
About 90, I think it was about 95, 96.
Roslyn was a busy time then, like, wasn't it?
Do you know what? It wasn't. Now it is.
Really?
Like now, like years ago, like when I had my misspent youth, at the end of Roslyn Main Street, you go down and there's a glen, and it's a big, huge glen, and there's like a First World War cemetery. There's like a waterfall. There's Rockies, and it's an amazing place. And do you know, like, we used to go down there as kids, and at that point the chapel had been left to just go to ruin. It was covered. It's the most ornate small chapel. It's a 15th century chapel. To go into it and you'll have a look around, it's just like your hairs are up on end and everything.
Crazy.
It's an amazing place. But at that point, I'd been left to kind of just rot.
Yeah.
So we used to go down there as kids, 14, 15 years old, with our carryouts, you know, hiding away from people. And I always remember one of my friends got married, and when she got married in the chapel, and there's lovely pictures of her in the gardens. And but on the other side of that wall, there was spray paint saying "Nick loves Jake" from when we were 15. But now it's like, I think it's Historic Scotland or cool. Something like that that's taken over, and they've put a big coffee shop on it. And I think there's something like anywhere between 300,000 and 500,000 visitors a year to the chapel.
Yeah.
And it's just a different place now. It's a completely different place. But it's still very, you know, you're somewhere special when you're there.
Yeah. What's a ley line?
Ley lines, they are energetic, like spiritual kind of, what are they called again, that go around the world? Just ley lines that go around the world. They're like map points.
Yeah.
Do you know that you have your longitude and your latitude lines? So it's these ley lines, and it's seemingly the two that cross. I'm just talking off the top of my head here, where the two of them cross, it's a really, really mystical point.
So the reason why I bring this up, because mystically, I was talking to a mate about this last night, and I've never talked about ley lines before. I don't even really know what they are until you just explained them to me. And there was some sort of piece of knowledge in my head that some professor or lecturer that I'd listened to, maybe as part of uni or something, had said that a lot of churches are built on ley lines intentionally because I think in Celtic Christianity they refer to them as like thin places, like places where like the barrier between heaven and earth is incredibly thin. And I was like, whoa, so the fact you brought up today, I was like, gotta ask what's happening.
And I think they are also reference points for certain things. So for people, so as I'd said already, you know, the holy relics and stuff all being there. So, and the fact that they cross here and the chapel's there, right, yeah, in front of them.
Yeah.
And there's a castle and stuff down there. And there's also, if you stand on the ley lines here and where they cross in Roslyn, you have the Roslyn Chapel right in front of you there. And however many miles to the, I think it's the left, you have the Coves of Gilmerin. And the Coves of Gilmerin is an underground tunnel, an underground tunnel system. That
I've never wanted to go somewhere so much in my life than right
it's
now.
Amazing, absolutely amazing. And it comes from Edinburgh Castle.
Wow.
So the Coves in Gilmerton, one of my friends actually is the tour. So one of my friends is a tour guide for the chapel and for, she knows all about the Knights Templar. She knows all about the history around that time. She's a historian. And she does a lot of tours and various things. And she had heard about these underground tunnels.
Yeah.
So the council had put in however much funding, you know, they had said, right, we'll clear these tunnels. And when they cleared them, they realised they had uncovered what looked like an illegal drinking den. And so the illegal drinking den and the meet-up point was right underneath the crossroads in a place called Gilmerton, which worked out to be ley lines again.
My goodness.
So this was almost like, so it was like an underground meeting point, but then what they noticed was there was tunnels go off to all the places. Now, there's a place called Temple as well, and if you stand at the ley lines in Roslyn, it's however many miles from there in a straight line takes you to Temple.
Wow.
So, and you can go and tour that, but then there was so much, the council got to the point where they had given whatever amount of money and it had excavated and cleared so much of it, but then they couldn't really do any more.
Yeah.
So you still, like, you can go and you can have a tour around and you can actually see where they would have served the beer and where they had, it's amazing.
Crazy.
And in the Roslyn Chapel, they done, what was the wee guy's name? An historian guy who does TV programs, a wee guy with glasses, his name's left me, but he came out and they were excavating under there. But then the Sinclairs, who own the chapel, they had got 6 feet under, and at that point they were redoing the roof of the chapel because it's natural sandstone and it had started to crumble, and they'd put this big canopy over it to dry it out. So they came out, and when they started to excavate, once they got to about 6 feet, there was new cracks starting to appear.
Oh, wow.
So the Sinclairs, who owned it, just said, right, stop all work.
Yeah.
Whatever's under there is meant to be under there, and that is it.
No.
But they had uncovered a bit of it, and then they found that there's underground tunnels as well. So
crazy.
It all links up some way. Do you know, at some point it's been a way to get from Edinburgh Castle to all these outlining places, maybe for royalty, for dignitaries, for, you know, people who maybe didn't want to travel by road.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just so fascinating.
That is so interesting. Like, there's part of my brain that's like trying to like really grasp at straws and use this as some sort of a metaphor for like the conscious and the subconscious. But we'll maybe get back to that later on. Talk to me about the carry out in the chapel. Really, this stupid question. What color were the carry out bags in Scotland? Like, we would have like wee like blue bags with the clinking bottles.
Yep.
You share that cultural meme? Okay.
We had the blue clinking bags, but we also had, years ago, we used to have tartan bags. You would get tartan bags from the shops.
Unbelievable. How cultured is that? Like?
Or you would have, now I'm trying to think the name. So back then it was mace.
Yeah, we have mace. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So mace was back then.
My corner shop as a kid was a mace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And let me think, what was the... There's a Co-op, and then there was William Lowe's. So William Lowe's bags as well. And that was like a local supermarket.
Yeah.
So you had, there was William Lowe's in Pennycook, and there was William Lowe's that took over the local shop in Roslyn.
Nice.
But a lot of the carryouts, Matt, to be honest, were like what we would call Mickey Finns. They were stolen from the Jinx cabinets at home. Do you know? And it was like,
why Mickey Finns? You've no idea. There must be some Wikipedia page on Mickey Finns.
That's it. And it would be like Cinzano with whiskey,
sure,
and rum, and you know, my dad drank Blackheart OVD rum, which is dark rum.
Yeah,
so we'd mix that with. And I remember my friend had a soda stream machine. We used to put in the soda stream. And I look back now and I think, oh, yuck.
Yeah. So a lot of people listening can relate to the carryout experience from all sorts of ages, most of us far too young. You imagine the group of people that you would have a carry out with. I don't know how many there were. Say there's like 6 to 10 or whatever.
Yep.
So there's those in the group who that's fine. And then they all go and become doctors and lawyers or have a really steady job working in a factory or whatever. And then there's those in that group who get plunged into the realm of hungry ghosts.
Absolutely.
So why do you think you then were susceptible to addiction? Why do you think it was taken further for you than maybe some of the other people in that group? That's a question I always think is interesting.
And you know what, Matt? We're all susceptible to addiction. It's true. Just choose different behaviours. So
different drugs of choice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So your drug of choice can be shopping. Your drug of choice can be really negative thinking to the point that it's making you unwell. You know, it can be cocaine. It can be amphetamine. But for me, I had... So when I was born, my mum had a wee boy before me and he had passed away. He was only... I always said he was 6 weeks, but I've recently been doing quite a lot of ancestral clearing and healing and been doing like a family tree. So my dad had came over at Christmas and brought lots of birth and death certificates and stuff.
Brilliant.
And what I found out is actually my big brother only lived for 6 days.
Ooh.
So I don't know where I got the 6 weeks from, but this is, you know, it was a story that had kind of been passed down. So, and my mum had wanted a wee boy. My mum and dad were married for 5 years. She'd had a couple of miscarriages and then had my sister and then had this wee boy, Mark, and then he passed away. So when she was pregnant with me, she was told when they were scanning, I was lying in a funny way and they were going to turn me around because it looked like I was going to be born feet first.
Yeah.
So when they went in to turn around, they kept saying, oh, and he's just going to do this and we're just going to do this with him. And she had that in her head. She was having this wee boy.
Which is so common, like it's the same way, like if you're walking down the street and you see an animal, a dog, usually the first thing you say, okay, look at him, isn't he so lovely?
That's it.
Interesting.
That's it.
Yeah.
And so when I was born and my mum realised I was a little girl and they said, and at that point, you know, back in the days, men didn't really go to the hospital. Well, they did, but not my dad. My dad was at work and was just kind of like, oh, that's women's things.
Yeah. The Victorian style.
That's it. I'll see it when it's about 6 months old.
Yeah.
So the first words I heard were, oh, I didn't want a wee girl.
Yeah.
I wanted a wee boy.
Yeah.
So she was desperately, my mum was desperately heartbroken that she never had a wee boy. And it was almost like that. I've already got a wee girl. Like, I don't want.
Yeah.
And I screamed for the first kind of 6 months of my life. Mm-hmm. And back in the days, it was just not long after. There was someone wrote a book during World War II, a German woman who had said, you know, to build a nation of people who are resilient, who are tough and blah, blah, you let babies cry out. You let them know that they have to be there for themselves. And blah. And that went on to be the story that you leave children, you leave babies to cry, which we now know is just so wrong because a baby needs to know. If a baby, the only way they can communicate is through crying. They need to know there's someone there who's going to meet their needs. They need to know that they're safe, that they're secure, that there's people there for them. But as I say, so I screamed and screamed and screamed to the point that the neighbours used to come up and be like, Mary, for goodness sake, can you not hear her crying?
Yeah.
And she'd be like, she does it all the time. So my mum had become so desensitised, so kind of like compassionately just cut off because she had so much of her own childhood trauma. Her mum had so much trauma. My gran was alcohol dependent. My mum then started to become alcohol dependent. So there was this huge dynamic that was going on when I was just a kid. My dad's mum had passed away when he was just a baby. So there was lots of things. My dad was really emotionally disconnected. So I was born into this energy of disconnection, of like, and my mum and dad, they were amazing people, absolutely amazing people. And nobody means to cause harm or do the people are just get so caught up in what's happening for them. So when I was about 8 months old, through my mum being, you know, organised with something else, I came flying along a hallway out the front door and down 30 concrete steps in a baby walker. And when we're born with just over 300 bones. By the time our bones fuse and form, we're left with just about 206, I think it is. And I was kind of at that point, my bones were just starting to fuse and form. So nothing was broken. Everything just swole up. So my whole face swelled up. My whole immune system was like firing off.
Yeah.
And then when I was about, I remember, like, there were so many things. Like, my mum's drinking had just started to become a thing. So we were left in vulnerable situations. Mm-hmm. And when I was two, my wee brother was born. So it was almost like that, you know, as a two-year-old, like, what have I done wrong? Like, why?
Yeah.
Do you know, I hardly got any attention as it was. And yeah. Now he's came along, mm-hmm. and which is perfectly natural way to think for a two-year-old.
Of course.
So I remember just, you know, being left. I don't actually remember, but, you know, being left in vulnerable situations because my mum was occupied with her own stuff. My mum was struggling with her own trauma and struggling with to make sense of the reality that she had. Mm-hmm. And I remember being 4 years old and I was running from something, or I'm not sure, but I remember lying in the long grass and my heart beating out my chest, like really, like my whole body was just like,
yeah.
And I remember watching myself coming out of myself, looking down on myself, and then floating away. And it was such a profound experience, and I never spoke to anybody about it. It's only been maybe about the last 5-6 years I've actually spoken about that, because I thought, people are going to think I have lost the plot if I talk about stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They're going to be like, you want us to take this woman seriously? So it stuck with me. And then I remember being 8 years old and at a party at my mum and dad's house, and there used to be parties quite a lot at our house. And I remember just watching everybody drinking and watching people getting drunker and drunker and drunker and thinking, what's in that glass?
Yeah, I'm going to try
that.
What is happening there?
So I remember kind of, and again, the Mickey Finn getting a glass and pouring some of that and pouring some of that and pouring some of that and going behind the sofa. And at that point, if my mum raised her voice, I would wet myself.
Yeah.
Do you know? So I was getting bullied at the school because I was stinking of pee. I wore National Health glasses. That, you know, they're the big, heavy, old-fashioned, like the girls got the pink, the boys got the blue. So I was covered in sores. I was covered in like big rash on my head here that was now, I know that it's eczema, but at the time they were saying, oh, it's because she's going in the fields too much. It's ringworm, it's this, it's that. So, you know, I would stinky things like Polytar shampoo, which was rank, anybody that's used it. I was covered in cream and I had to have gloves on and all these different things.
Yeah.
And I remember behind that sofa and having that drink the first time. And it was almost like, you know, my subconscious mind went, boom, solution.
Nice.
This feels nice. I didn't feel anxious. I didn't feel like I was kind of running on empty the whole time. And I remember coming out from behind the sofa and kind of just feeling a bit warm and a bit glowy.
You should hear the soundtrack in my head right now. It's just like so like idyllic.
I remember coming out and just like, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
And then I was drinking from when I was eight. And that again was, and what happens is our subconscious mind looks for solutions. It looks for how can we, because it wants to serve. That's its prime directive, is it wants to serve and it needs clear orders. So my subconscious mind said anxiety, you know, like heightened cortisol levels, heightened heart rate, you know, everything kind of up at max. And this kind of takes it down a wee bit. Solution.
Yeah.
So, and it goes off and does other stuff. Very rarely does the subconscious mind go, hang on a minute, see that solution you found? It's actually causing an issue now.
Yeah.
And what that taught me was that avoid, deny, swerve. Do you know, if you can get away from these difficult, uncomfortable emotions by using some behavior, some substance, some environment.
To get you away from it.
Exactly. So started smoking cannabis when I was 13.
Yep.
I was running away from home and stuff at 15. And then got married when I was 18, had my son. And I got married to a guy who other people were really scared of. He was quite a big, kind of burly guy.
Yep.
And, you know, I remember watching him going up to, there was the people where we lived, they shoplifted like everything. They would take the sugar out your tea. And I remember this guy shoplifting stuff and my ex-husband going up and saying, I'll take that. And the guy just kind of going, okay. And of course, my subconscious mind, my wee child who was frightened, who was scared, who was still inside me with her hands over her eyes, still hadn't been rescued, was like,
Solution.
He'll look after me.
Mm-hmm.
People are scared of him. Nobody will hurt me if he's there. Mm-hmm. I'll make sure. So there was all of this stuff. Now, taking it into account, by age eight, I'd experienced every abuse that you mm-hmm. could imagine. You know, just, and not directly at the hands of my mum and dad, but just through being left, as I said, in vulnerable situations. So, yeah, that never ended well, Matt.
Yeah.
So after a couple of years.
A bit like the drink, though, isn't it? It's the solution you think is the solution that becomes the problem.
That's it.
Yeah.
So I ended up homeless, and I was living on the street, and my husband had, I'd ended up, after I was living on the street, I'd been put in a homeless hostel. But this was like 1992, and things were very different back then. And, you know, anyone who was experiencing homelessness was placed in the same place. It didn't matter if it was, if you had children, if you were alcohol dependent, if you were, you know, it was just everybody was kind of put in the same place.
Just free for all.
So, you know, it was just, when I think back on it now, I'm just like, oh, geez, that was character building. But in that period in time and in that hostel, I met a guy there who was doing coke. And he was like, you should try that. No, in fact, it wasn't. It was amphetamine. And he said, you should try this. So, of course, I was like, boom, love this. So that was the 90s. It was the dance era. It was, I had been into acid house music in the sort of late 80s. So there was a lot of stuff there. And then I ended up being a dancer in a nightclub, and I got paid in drugs and alcohol. And it was just that hedonistic bubble that was just like, yeah. This is great.
Yeah.
Smoking cannabis every day. I was kind of living, starting to have panic disorder by that point. But I would get to a point where I would be like, oh, I'm using far too much of this. I'll go on and use something else. So I'd maybe say, God, I've drank like 2 bottles of Jack in the last 3 days. I'll go and get a bag of coke.
Yeah, and then it was like, I need the food pyramid. I need to diversify my diet a wee bit.
Exactly. But all of it was just avoidance. It was just, and anybody who speaks, you know, about addiction, it's avoidance. And it's, and, but what it tends to happen is people get so caught up on the person's behavior. Mm-hmm. And then they feel so guilty because they're saying, he does this or she does that or this and that. But it's not the person you're pissed off at. It's the behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And what we sometimes fail to do is separate them both and let that person know. And, you know, looking at, like, I've been doing quite a bit of shamanic stuff, and looking at, you know, the person with addiction is the person who's carrying the pain for that whole family line. It's not their pain. They don't understand it. They don't know where it comes from. They're not so. So there's lots of different things, and you'll hear, you know, people who are living with addiction, you know, will say, "I don't know why I do it. I don't know what." Like I'll say, and I used to say myself, "That's it. I'm not drinking. I am not drinking." And then 5 days later, it would be like 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd be finishing off the last of the Jack Daniels, and my finger in the air saying, "And I'll tell you another thing." and then the next again day, I would go, "Oh my God, I'm such a failure."
Yeah.
And the negative internal critic, because what tends to happen is when we have a wounded child inside us, we develop a judgmental adult based on the reality, the beliefs, the values, the demands of the environment that we've immersed ourselves within.
Mm-hmm.
So we have one part of us that's hiding our eyes, wanting rescued, is so scared, frightened, all of these things, and another part that's saying, oh my God, look at the state of you. Mm-hmm. You need to get yourself together. No wonder nobody loves you. No wonder you're a failure. You'll never make it. And blah, blah.
Yeah.
And that internal critic can become so debilitating to the point that it's like, well, there's no point in going out because everybody's going to be looking at you. Look at the state of you. And your world just becomes smaller and smaller and smaller because your internal world becomes the most driving force for everything. So all through my 20s, that's exactly what happened. And then when I was 29, I went from being slightly unwell
mm-hmm.
to completely unconscious in 6 hours. And I got rushed into the hospital. They thought it was meningitis. And they'd done lots of, you know, lumbar puncture and various different things. And everything came back that there was nothing. Do you know? And the doctors, when I came back too, before I even opened my eyes, do you know, the voice was like, oh, my God. Look, and in the background, I can hear beep.
Yeah.
And the voice is like, oh my God, look at the state of you now. What have you done? You're a disgrace. You should have your kids taken off you. You should have, oh my God, and blah, blah, blah. And it was just like, but there was another voice, and that voice was like, stop this. If you don't stop this, you're going to die. And I'd never heard that voice before.
Okay, that was my question.
Mm.
That was the first time you heard that voice.
Mm.
What do you think, hindsight's 2020, but what do you think's going on there? Why did that voice only emerge in that moment with the beep, beep?
Because I believe we all have an opportunity to live twice. But we have to realise that the first life is actually the only life we've got. And in that point of almost dying and having that near-death experience, there was something inside me that was just like, buck up your ideas. And I think that was the first time I kind of really connected to my true and authentic self. It was the first time that I'd had that essence of me that was just like, you've got work to do here. Like, why are you doing that? Like, I don't know. I look back on it and I just like, but that voice remained with me. And when I got out of the hospital, and I mean, it was a case of, as soon as my eyes were open, within 6 hours, I was like, I need to go home because I need to. And in my head, I was going, my neighbours will be talking about me. The tiny wee village, Roslyn.
Everybody in the village. I cannot even imagine, honestly.
Everybody in the village will be talking about me. Like, everybody, nobody. And when you find yourself talking about everybody, nobody, somebody, these are huge sweeping generalisations to make things worse than they actually are.
Yeah, there's a one we always use in our marriage. Whenever one of the people in the marriage starts saying, always, it's just a red flag. You always do this, or it's always, and it's like a red flag. It's like almost like a banned word. And as soon as it comes up, you're like, interesting. Let's actually like dissect that a little bit and see if it's true.
Or never. You're never there for me. Exactly. You never do this.
Yeah.
So language is massive. But at that point, I never knew any of that. I never realized that. But I remember leaving that hospital that day and something fundamentally has changed. And people talk about, you know, getting that, as you were saying about that veil, that really thin veil between this world and the next, or this world and the latter, or whatever it is, and whatever you believe in, there is that really fine line between, like, where did I go in that time? Where did I go in the 2 days?
Yeah.
And why did I come back? Mm-hmm. Like, why did I look back now and I know that it was my body and mind's way of saying, we are not supporting this lifestyle anymore. This body is filled to the neck with trauma. And again, you know, trauma is not an event. People think trauma has to be something that happens. Like, an event is part of it, but it's what happens inside of us in response to that event. So 10 people can go through exactly the same thing. 9 people walk away and never think about it again. And 1 person walks away and it's all they think about for the rest of their life. And they have flashbacks and they have nightmares and they have limiting beliefs and decisions about themselves, other people and the world because of that event. And then they speak to someone who shared that event with them and they're like, what are you talking
about,
mate?
Don't be such a pussy.
Fuck's sake, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. And you even see that in siblings of families of abuse, you know, where some siblings seemingly walk away, seemingly scotch-free, the other can be completely debilitated, you know. It's interesting.
But you see it in, like, family dynamics really fascinate me. But even in terms of our internal family dynamics, so inside me is, you know, we're all like Russian dolls. Do you know, inside of us, the core of us is that tiny wee child. And if that tiny wee child's needs are not being met in a fundamental way that's productive to human existence, then there's always kind of needs. There's always going to be parts. There's always going to be, you're always going to develop a part of you to protect, but also to serve. So, you know, there'll be a part that'll be, well, I'll stand in and I'll, you know, I'll be your shy part. So when other people start to talk, I'll make you go bright red. So then people will not ask you anything because they'll be so busy going, oh, look, oh, how cute. Oh, she must be really shy.
Yeah.
And it deflects and takes away. So we create these parts of us. But when I left the hospital bed that day, there was a decision there and then that was like, right, something needs to change.
And again, I just really want to underscore that because this is what I'm really loving about this conversation. That shyness, you know, that character that kind of emerges to act as a defense. Again, it's just like the drink and the husband. It's the solution that ends up being the problem. And that is what my mind just keeps coming back to so far. But anyway, sorry, keep going.
But you know, also the messages and the stories that we get shown and get embroiled within can have a huge impact on us. So because my mum's drinking, like my sister was, she was the quiet, shy child, and she kept her head down and done really well at school and never really drew attention. I was a bit more rebellious. I would fight my shadow. And I was always the one telling jokes. And so my whole demeanour, my whole persona, the part I had developed was I can be a smokescreen. I can tell jokes and laugh and sing and be really loud, because if I make a distraction, nobody will really know what's going on over there.
Wow.
And then my brother was just, he just was so lost and confused. And of course, he was the boy she always wanted. Yeah. So as well as, you know, my mum's drinking getting worse, you know, we'd maybe get taken to pubs and we'd have to sit outside, but Jason would get taken in. And there was lots of different things. Like all our experiences were completely separate,
yeah,
because we give it very separate meaning based on our previous experience. So we're always comparing and contrasting. So as a kid, I was told when I was inside the house, don't you tell anyone what's happening in here. Mm-hmm. You'll end up in care. Your mum will get in trouble. I'll get in trouble for not protecting you. And my dad was doing what he thought was the right thing to do, because he was petrified.
Sure.
He was absolutely petrified. And he was kind of going, how do I deal with this behaviour? Yeah. And his coping mechanism was, I'll just pretend it's not happening. So things would happen and then we'd get up the next again day and it was like, and it was like, yeah, do you want a cuppa? It was like, are we going to address the blood on the walls? Are we going to address the fact that we've no plates because they've all been smashed? But then when I was on the other side of the door, my dad was saying, now never think you're better than anybody else. Don't tell lies. Always do your best. So I was kind of going, right, hang on a minute. So there was a part of me that said, right, you always need to keep a secret. Because that's the thing for me. So I always had this secret that, oh God, if people really knew what was going on inside my house, which then became, oh my God, if people really knew what was going on inside my head, if people really knew how much cocaine I was taking, people really knew, even down to food. Do you know, at one point, I think I was about 7 stone and I had went to the doctor and I knew I needed help. Mm. And I went to the doctor and I said, I'm just not really that hungry, and I made up this big, huge story, and he's seen right through it, and sent me a referral for the Royal Eds, is the mental health hospital.
Yeah.
And as soon as I got that letter, I was like, he knows.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Like, that's for crazy people. I'm not going to do that. And pretty much overnight, Matt, I then was able to eat. And make myself sick. And within the space of about a month or so, I had it perfected. I could eat and then be back in a minute and come back. And people would, and then I was like, nobody knows I'm doing this.
Nice secret.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that happened for a couple of years. So there was the whole food thing. Mm-hmm. So there was the substances thing. There was the behaviour thing. Mm-hmm. So when, as I say, in 1999, when this happened, I spent a couple of years, and anybody who's tried to stop any kind of behaviour, it's not just, do you know what, I'm going to stop that now, and you sail off into the sunset, and it's just done and dusted overnight.
Yeah.
Does not happen.
Yeah.
So this was 1999. So I was on the wagon, off the wagon, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and floods of tears, because emotionally I was still like, what does this mean? What is going on? In 2001, I got an opportunity to go to China and walk 100 miles of the Great Wall, and I was to raise money for charity. And I remember speaking to an ex-boyfriend in a bar, and I was saying to him, do you know what? This boyfriend had dealt drugs from my house, had my house busted by the police, had stole money off me, had slept with my friend, but I stayed friends with him because the one thing I could not cope with was rejection. Because remember, from the very point of birth, I felt rejection and I didn't like it.
Yeah.
So I was sitting and I was telling him, I'm going to go to China and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. And he looked at me and shook his head and he said, your head is full of broken bottles. Do you want another Jack? And he got up and went to the bar. And I remember looking at the back of his head and thinking, I will make you eat your words. I'm going to go to China. And again, I worked in science at the time. So not only did I raise £2,600, I put in an application with help for one of the guys that I was working with for £18,000 and another one for £22,000. So I raised over £42,000 for the charity. Went off to China, and every morning I was there with 52 people I'd never met before. I was living with panic disorder. I was challenging so many things. I was at a point where I was going, there needs to be a message in this somewhere. What is the learning in this? Mm-hmm. And every morning I got up like an hour before the girl I was sharing the room with, or half an hour or 40 minutes or whatever. And I got up and I sat in the mirror and I looked at myself in the mirror and I looked straight at the essence of me. And I was like, listen, if you're coming, panic, you come now because you're not embarrassing me in front of these people. Mm. So I would start to think about things. And a couple of mornings, I would have a bit of a panic and I would be like, and I'd burst into floods of tears, or I'd be sick, or I'd be, but then I was like, right, that's it. So later on in the day, if I started to feel anxious or panic, that wee voice that was like, please stop this, was in my head and it was going, panic.
You had your time. You had your workout this morning. You like, go to bed.
You're no blowing this for her. And like, I was scared of heights. So I climbed a mountain at 2,000 feet and I'd done a zip slide right across these two, in between these two mountains and this like river. And it was like, you know, I think I was up in the sky for something like 12 and a half minutes. That's how long it took for this zip slide to get from one side
to
another. It was
a long
miles.
Time. Wow.
And I was clipped on with like a big carabiner. It was China in 2001. Health and safety, even the structure I was standing on to do it, I was a bit like, this is really wobbly. And then I thought, do you know what? If you're going to face your fears, like, this is the best place to do it.
Yeah.
So there were so many things I challenged. There were so many things that I just thought, do you know, what is this about? Mm-hmm. So I came back and I fell asleep and I had jet lag and I slept for 30 odd hours. Mm-hmm. And I woke up and I was like, I have just had the most mental dream. And then turned around and seen my suitcase with the stickers on it and bags from the airport. And I was like, fuck that. I never dreamt that.
Yeah.
That was real. And again, that wee voice was like, imagine what else you could do.
Wow.
And I was like, whoa. Imagine if I just challenged every belief I had about myself, other people, and the world. And I challenged it in a way that was respectful. And I challenged it in a way that was like, do you know what? I know that's what I've been doing. But what else does that mean? So that kind of set me on a different way of thinking. And then, so I started to volunteer for a charity. And always at that point, I was like, I really want to work with trauma and addiction. Mm-hmm. But I was like, do you know, I'm too messed up. Like, and hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I need to heal before I can do anything like this.
I was going
to
say, it came into my head, like, heal thyself, physician. You know, how many people get into the world because they haven't yet dealt with the very thing they're trying to heal in other people.
Exactly.
You know, it's a big thing.
And a lot of people get into the healing profession because they want to live their they want to live their rescue story through the people that come to see them.
Yeah.
And I just think for me that just doesn't sit right. And for other people, they think they're doing the best. And you know, and that's where and that's why this industry has so many people who experience compassion fatigue. And compassion fatigue is not a loss of compassion for others. It's you forgot to be compassionate with yourself. And when you're not compassionate for yourself, if you have no compassion for yourself, if you have no love for yourself, if you have no positive regard for yourself, how can you possibly offer that to someone else?
Mm.
Because we can only offer what we have inside.
You can't pour from an empty cup.
Exactly. So I started volunteering for young people who were leaving the care system, and they were making that transition from being looked after and accommodated to independent living. And I just thought, you know, I can give back here. I was never actually in care, but I was on the cusp of it. And I know what it's like to have disconnection within the family unit. I know what it's like to live with abuse. I know what it's like to, you know, really question yourself. I know what it's like to be almost like fighting for survival every day and, you know, just lashing out and hitting people. So I knew what it was like to have that level of disconnection. And within about 3 or 4 months of volunteering, one of the girls that worked here was like, Viv, you should be working here. This is the type of work you should be doing. And having that almost like seeing myself through someone else's eyes, I was kind of going, do you think? Oh, I don't think I'd be any good at that. I don't think I'd be. And she was like, you would be great at this. So I started, I volunteered, then I took on a part-time job with them. Within 6 months, I was full-time with them. Within a year, I was the head of the project. And I started doing stuff in schools, and we had a house and education program. And it was working with young people to get them to, you know, just to upskill them. And should you ever find yourself in a position where you're homeless? And it was all around homelessness, and it was all around, you know, just like, how do you transition from that childhood into that adulthood kind of role, especially if you have a so many young parts of you that are in an arrested development, that are so scared, that are so vulnerable, and they just keep replaying behaviours and keep replaying behaviours. And I was kind of going, do you know, I went from that domestic violence relationship to another relationship that involved violence and drug use and to another relationship that done the same thing. And it was this cycle that I was kind of going, do you know, I'm starting to recognise this. And if I could get young people to recognise this at an early stage, the impact that could have. And one of the guys that had been working with us was a guy called Lucas, a Swedish guy. I'll never forget him. And he said, and I had never told my story at that point, and I had, because I was kind of, oh, nobody wants to know that.
Yeah,
people will reject me.
I'll get fired.
They'll not want to have anything to do with me. And he had said, have you ever tried floating? And I was like, floating? And he was like, honestly, Viv, it is amazing. You should try it. Come on, we'll take you. So we went, and I went into the room, and at that point it was a pod. So it was like this egg-shaped, mm-hmm. coffin-like structure, yeah. right? And instantly in my head I'm going, no way am I getting in there. Like, back in 1999 on that hospital bed, I decided I wanted to live. Why the fuck would I put myself into a coffin-like structure, in there, by myself, in the dark, with just this head and these thoughts? Forget it. So I'm standing looking at the cabin. I'm standing looking at the pod going, nah, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do it. And then that voice again in my head was like, get over yourself and get in the bloody water. Mm. And I got in and I lay there. And the first 5 minutes I was like, well, this is pretty rubbish. And this is, oh no, and I'm going to be thinking about all this mental stuff. And like, I wonder how long I've been in here for. Does this get, I wonder if, can I hear anything? Is what's going on? And then boom, silence. And then I had this profound kind of vision.
Yeah.
Where I could see myself on a stage and I was talking and I was just on the stage, walking up and down the stage talking. And then I was floating through a float centre and I was floating through the walls and there was people doing one-to-one therapy and there was float tanks and there was a reception area and there was a child's area at the back. And in the booking, the diary in reception, there was like NHS written on Tuesday and NHS written on Wednesday. And it was like all of these things. And then I heard, that's your time up. And I was like, boom, jumped straight up out the water. And I was like, holy shit, what just happened there?
Yeah.
And I just had this renewed sense of, well, it's not even a renewed sense, like a brand new sense of, oh, I'm here for something really special. I'm like, I've got a purpose. Mm-hmm. Not sure what it is. And it was almost like that. I need to get dressed. And I was looking at the water and I was thinking, what? Like, it's just like,
what did they put in that?
What's going on? So I went out and I said to the woman in the centre, I was like, oh my
Googling,
God.
Googling, can you get high off salt fumes?
And I was like, what happened in there? Mm-hmm. And I started telling her this stuff and she said, yeah, it's a lovely spa treatment. And I was like, no. This is not a spa treatment. This is a mental health intervention. Tell me what happened in my mind. What happened? And so I left and as I was walking up the road, I just remember there was just this renewed sort of feeling that part that left when I was 4 years old, that part in that long grass that went, this body's too dangerous. This body's so emotionally charged. We'll come back when this part's over, had came home.
Interesting.
And it was like, right, now the research is done. Let's go and change the world. Let's go and do whatever it is we're going to do. And I remember walking up that road going, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do this. And I'm on the bus, and then the critic...
Yeah.
How are you going to do that? You left school at 15. You're thick. You're stupid. Nobody's going to listen to you. You've not even got any money. How are you going to do blah, blah, blah? But again, that other voice was like, right, well, you're going to school. Go back to college. So I went to college and I studied health and social care. And I became really interested in, we have one of the most amazing systems in the world, the NHS. It really is. It's a pillar for so many things. But it's also to our detriment sometimes because a lot of people have become so dependent on, I'm broken, you're a doctor, you have a pen and a prescription pad, so you will fix me.
Yeah.
And by doing that, I'll also then be able to get this benefit. And so
you've gamified the system almost.
And we've disempowered so many people to believe that, you know, but again, this comes from an ancestral belief that the state will pay for me. The state will pay. And I was in that. I had been in that for such a long time. So I became really interested in, you know, what are the fundamentals? What are the underpinning values and models of our health and social care system? And where in some areas we were excelling and it was absolutely amazing. There were other areas we were seriously, seriously failing people and letting people down. And working with young people leaving the care system, I seen that clearly. You know, these were young people who at some point in their life, their environments had been so so disconnecting for them, so negative for them, so debilitating for them, that the state, that the councils, local councils, the local police departments, the local social work departments had sought the permission to remove these children from their families. And then at 16, 17 years old, we were putting them in high-rise flats in one of the most, the areas of such deep poverty and in economic activity and, you know, like just really areas of high deprivation of, you know, massive drug use, crime and giving them benefits and then kind of going, right, well, that's your flat.
Yeah.
And these young people are like, How are they going to make money? How are they going to? Yeah. What kind of jobs are they going to
Where's
get?
The path?
But there was just, and I thought, there's such so many young people being failed massively. So from there, I then went to university and I studied social science and I became really interested in group dynamics, and how one person's thought process can change so many people around about them, and how simply the use of language, somebody can say one thing and three or four people go, oh, I never saw it like that. Instantly, you've changed the world for that person.
It's the idea virus, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But how it could be used in such a detrimental way. You just have to look at what Maggie Thatcher done with the poll tax in Scotland. She had this idea of this tax. We'll try it on the Scottish people first. And there were so many people who were going, oh, no, you couldn't do that. So she got six or seven of her closest confidants who would agree with her, who were able to push it through. And the next thing, in April 1989, the poll tax was introduced in Scotland. And there was a huge uproar. The whole nation went mental.
Yeah.
Eventually ended up getting scrapped. But then I thought, you know, I'm a group of people.
Yeah.
Inside me, as I've said, is that Russian dolls. Is they like, so there's Vivian the scared child, there's Vivian the rebellious teenager, there's Vivian the mum, there's Vivian the sister, there's Vivian the daughter, there's Vivian the worker, there's all these. I thought, what if I appointed a CEO? And I appointed a CEO who had like a big powwow meeting and said, right, I want everybody in my office because I want to know, how can I support you? What's your needs and wants and how can they be met? How have they not been met previously? And just apologise and give gratitude to each and every part to say, thank you so much. You've done a great job up until now.
Yeah.
But I'm here now. So you're having a holiday.
Yeah.
We're sending you on vacation. You're going away to wherever. And so then from there, I moved to Northern Ireland and then...
Why here?
I had... So I met a guy in 2002 and I spent about, I don't know, 8 weeks, a few months anyway, with him. And then we'd split up. We'd had... And again, this is another story. So he... I drove at that point, right? Now, taking into account, at one point my friends were drug dealers, gangsters and prostitutes.
Sure.
That was like... It was just... That's the way my life was.
Yeah.
So I had this blue Orion, right? A car. I absolutely loved this Ford Orion. And, but there was something wrong with it where if I drove it and it hit up, if I switched it off, I'd have to wait till it cooled down again before I could start it again. So I used to drive this car. I'd go my shopping. I'd leave it in Tesco's running in the car park. And like people would say, are you not scared it would get stolen? And I'm like,
not really.
Who's going to steal my car? Do you know, I'd have it back by 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Do you know, I'd be able to find out exactly who had it because of the network and who I was involved in. So I had went to the races at Ayr one day and I had met Tommy and we ended up seeing each other for a few months and I had driven over to his house. He lived in Irvine and I lived in Edinburgh. So we were 2.5 miles drive from each other. So I had driven over to visit him and I think, as I say, we were only together a few months and he said, I've got a surprise for you. At that point, I hated surprises because surprises could mean
danger,
anything.
Yeah.
Do you know, like... and I was like, right, what is it? What is it? And he says, come here. So we went and we went to the front of the house and one of his friends was a mechanic and somebody had traded in this black Volvo. I'll never forget it. They traded in this black Volvo and he had got it for like a couple hundred quid.
Wow.
And had an MOT on it and it was like, and he said, I've got your car. Right? And I was like, what? And he said, well, do you know, that that car you're driving about in Viv, like, it's a death trap. And I'm every time you drive away from here, I'm always thinking, oh God, is she going to make it home in time? And my instant reaction was, what does he want?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What does he want? Like, this is, because again, one of my patterns and one of my memories and the golden thread of that memory in childhood was, if I was given something nice, it meant something was about to happen. Mm. Or if I was given something nice, it was as an apology or a sorry for something that had already happened. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, a car. This is not a bag of sweets or a horse riding lesson.
It's a huge debt.
This is, yeah, like, weirdo. What does he want? Like, I bet he's going to kidnap me and tie me up in a room, and he's going to blah, blah, blah. And I had all of this story going on in my head, and I was like, I need to get out of here. I need to get away from here. So about maybe half an hour, 40 minutes later, once I knew my car had cooled down and I could start it up again, I was like, I need to go. I can't even remember. It was something like, you know, I need to wash my hair, or I've left the iron on or something. And he was like, what? And I left, got in my car, cried all the way home, got to the house and thought, do you know, I need to finish with him. I can't. So drove all the way back again. So 7.5 hours this day I had driven, right? Drove back, told him, like, it's not you, it's me. I'm like, blah, 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 done the whole thing. Like, don't even bother trying to get me to the door. It's fine, I'll go. I had to make sure I stayed for half an hour, 40 minutes. Was the car. Got back in the car and drove back. And that was it. I was like, do not phone me, do not contact me, do not come anywhere near me. 8 years later, I came across him on Facebook. We got in touch in the March. He visited Scotland in the April to visit me. He had moved over here in that 8 years. So he came back to Scotland to visit me. I came over here in the May and decided I was going to put my house on the market. Put my house on the market in the May. Moved over here in August. We got engaged the following April. We got married the following November. And then we had our son the following September. We fell pregnant on honeymoon.
Awesome.
So, and then I've been here ever since. Brilliant. But when I first came over, I got into neuro-linguistic programming.
Nice.
And I absolutely loved it.
NLP. What got you into that?
Loved it. It just made perfect sense to me. Neuro, your five senses, what you see, hear, feel, smell and taste. Mm. Linguistic, how you then create your world and create your speech in your own head. How you talk to yourself in your own head is a reflection of how you talk to other people. So what you how you speak to other people, you can tell a lot about people and what they think about themselves based on that.
Yeah.
And then programming. What are the patterns and the programs that have been carried down through generations? And I became really interested, especially in crime and stuff, because something that maybe seems so against our society now, murder, you know, paedophilia, you know, like domestic violence, you know, incest, all of these things that our society now, oh my goodness, if you go back 200 years, it was commonplace.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was, now, what that means is that pattern, that program has came down that family line and just never been challenged. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, they don't see themselves as bad, they don't see themselves, they are replaying what has either been shown to them, but that's a whole other thing. So I got really interested in NLP, and then I had read a book, and it was Richard Bandler and John Grindler. And then I found out that Richard Bandler comes to London and he does training in London. So at that point I had engaged with a trainer here, Dr. Emma James. So I'd done NLP practitioner, went to London, studied with Richard Bandler. He introduced me to Paul McKenna. He's quite a famous hypnotist. I went back to London, done some training with Paul McKenna, came back to Northern Ireland, done clinical hypnotherapy with Gavin Murphy. And then went back to London, done some more training with Paul McKenna. He introduced me to a thing called Havening. And I absolutely loved it. It just made perfect sense. Havening looks at a thing called Emily, and this is how we encode trauma. And as soon as I was introduced to it, I was like, boom, this is truer than true. And what it says is that for every trauma, there needs to be an event. Mm-hmm. There needs to be something happens in a relational context.
Okay.
There needs to be meaning. Now, we give meaning. When you look at NLP and you look at we take in everything through our five senses, we cannot take in every single bit of that, because every second of every day we're met by between 2 million and 6 billion, depending how connected we are, depending how much technology we use, depending on the conversations we have, the interactions we have. There's no way our mind could cipher all of that information. So we delete information that's not important to us. Mm-hmm. So someone can say something that we totally do not believe, understand, or engage with, and we'll completely bypass it. And later on, somebody will say, did you hear what they said? And you're like, well, they never said that.
Yeah.
They're like, they did. But you've deleted it because it doesn't. It's not important to you because you're busy trying to filter your stuff. Mm-hmm. We distort things to fit our view of the world. So someone could say something. So you maybe don't have much self-esteem, much self-confidence, much self-worth. You don't like attention. And somebody says, that's a really nice jacket. And you reply instantly with, oh, this old thing. Okay, fit it for it. And you'll deflect.
The Northern Irish classic is £5 Primark.
Exactly.
All the time.
Exactly.
All the time.
So we'll distort things. Or somebody will say something and you'll go, I know what you meant by that. And they're like, what are you talking about? You know what I'm talking about. Because you distort it. And yeah. Then we'll generalize. Nobody, everybody, somebody.
Always,
every
never.
Time, always, never. Like yeah. All of that. So we give personal meaning based on how we compare and contrast previous experiences. So the meaning we give something is very different. So hence why we can all have exactly the same event. We give a different meaning. Mm-hmm. The landscape of the brain can be one of two things, vulnerable or resilient. If it's resilient, then you're able to process lots of information coming in. And there's a really nice state called gamma. And it's when you're in flow. There's lots of information coming mm-hmm. in, what you see, hear, feel, smell, taste. You're giving it meaning. So, for example, you're passing kettlebells mm-hmm. and you're getting used to the weights of the kettlebells. You're watching as it leaves your hand, goes in somebody else's, and then you catch it and blah. And the landscape of the brain is resilient. I know if I let that go and blah. And you can really think, if the landscape of the brain is vulnerable and the point that you go, what does this mean? Oh, and there's confusion and there's chaos that reminds you of something else. Mm-hmm. And then there's an inability to escape, a perceived sense of being trapped. That gamma, what then happens is the brain starts to, in the part of the brain called the fight or flight, the amygdala, in that moment you have an event, you give it meaning. The landscape is, I am vulnerable and this is inescapable from. The amygdala pops out like a wee black box like you would get in an aeroplane. And it's like, right, what do I see, hear, feel, smell, taste? What's the meaning that I'm giving this? Because I need to keep a hold of this. Uh-huh. So if I'm ever in a situation where any of this is about, I'll keep you safe.
Wow.
Because that's what the subconscious mind does. It's there to keep you safe.
Yeah.
So it encodes it. And it encodes it in a way that, so say, for example, you are, you're in a car, right?
Yeah.
And anybody who's ever been in a car crash, you'll know at the point of you realizing, shit, I'm going to crash here, everyone slows down. It's almost like, whoa, and you can see it, slow motion playing. But that's because the prefrontal cortex, this part of the brain here, you're in the moment decision, your executive decision maker, he's like, whoa, I'm out of here. Mm. And it lets the fight or flight jump in because he's like, action, 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 move to yeah. action. So all of this is going on at that moment in time. So you bang the car in front of you. And at that moment, boom, there's like fresh car pine smell. There is Bob Marley playing on the radio. There's a red car in front of you. And all of that's encoded in that wee black box that's sitting in the amygdala. And there's a protein in the brain. And that protein is called PKZ. And it sticks it to the amygdala. And it's like a box of meerkats. It's like, don't you worry. I'll keep you safe. We'll keep a wee eye out. So 6 months later, you're walking through the shopping centre. And you're looking in Thornton's and your other ice cream shops, anyone. and you're looking and you're thinking, we'll have strawberry or chocolate. And in the background, Bob Marley comes on.
The wee meerkat
goes, oh, you're unsafe. This is part of this thing. Remember this thing that made you unsafe? So you're looking at the ice cream and you're like, actually, I feel too well. My heart's like, is it hot in here? Or is it just me? So again, the whole system's up. Mm. There's another AMPA receptor comes up and it's like, what do I see, hear, feel, smell and taste? Mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is shopping centres becomes part of the car crash experience.
Wow.
So you then go... someone says, do you want to come shopping? We'll go to Conswater. And you're like, yeah, yeah, no bother. And you get in the car and then you're like, oh, actually, I don't feel like I really want to go in the shopping centre. I don't know if it's because it's really hot or really busy or what. Mm-hmm. I just don't. And your world becomes smaller and smaller and smaller.
Then you don't want to get in the car.
And then distraction goes, what can we do to stop this? What can we do to get this? So you'll maybe start drinking. You'll maybe start using erratic behaviour. You'll maybe start you know, losing yourself in pornography. You'll maybe start really negative thinking all the time. You'll maybe start. So there's all of these things. And that fascinated the shit out of me. I was like, this is like proper neuroscience. And then with havening, you can apply certain touch, you can use various different things, and you can start to change the way the brain works. So you
this
can.
Is the Emily.
This, so this is using Emily.
Okay.
So so you watch for the Emily. You watch for the event, the meaning, the landscape, the inescapability, where that's been encoded. So if I'm sitting with someone, so say you're sitting with someone and you know, they're chatting away about something, and then they go, and then he done this, and this happened, and that happened, and blah, blah, blah. At that moment, that event is running in their neurology and in their physiology. Their body and their mind is reliving that because it's bringing on the tears. It's changing the voice to this. The body's getting tighter. The shoulders are up. And so everything's screaming, I am replaying this. I am reliving this, which tells me the mind's up in gamma. So it's back up in that really fast state.
Yeah.
If you can then use various different distractions, you can then use lateral eye movements. You can use rubbing of the arms and of the hands. What you do is you quickly allow the mind, invite the mind, to drop down into what's called delta wave. Delta wave is associated with deep and restful sleep. But if you can get someone to go from gamma to delta really quickly, you open up the calcium channels within the brain. Calcium and delta wave creates a chemical called calcineurin, and it dephosphorylates, unsticks the PKZ that's holding the black box in place.
Interesting.
So the black box gets a chance to dissolve and go back into the fight or flight. Mm-hmm. So it means that the emotional component that is in that memory, that's sticking it, that every time you remember it, it's like, woof, it's happening all over again, all over again, allows the emotional component of that to be dissolved. So that memory is allowed to be reprocessed back to where it should be. Mm-hmm. So if I said to someone, see on that day of the car crash, what did you have for your breakfast? And they're like, what? Why would I remember that?
Yeah.
Well, you've just told me that on the 4th of April 1989 at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you crashed into a red car, and there was a, how would you like that experience to go back like that? And as I say, that really fascinated me. And I was like, see, this whole neuroplasticity, this whole field of neuroscience, this whole that you can change, just because things have always been that way doesn't mean to say it always has to be. And it starts by simply changing your language. It starts by opening yourself up to possibility. Mm-hmm. Because possibility is part of compassion. It's like, you know, the compassion of possibility is allowing yourself to go, what if?
Yeah.
Just what if, rather than, I could never do that, or that would never happen to me. Things like that never happened to me. I could never make that kind of money. I could never run my own business.
Yeah.
Possibility of, what if I could? Yeah. Do you know, the two words, what if?
The two big things there is with the language possibility that I love, particularly in the Northern Irish context, or I imagine it's the exact same in Scotland. You're in a car with your mates and you go to the petrol station and you're filling up. And someone pulls up to you in like a real flashy BMW. Mm-hmm. And then mates in the back seat are like, what a wanker. Can you imagine like, what an arsehole, like driving a car like that? Like, what a prick. And then immediately you think about that and you unpack that and you're like, you're telling yourself in that moment that you'll never be rich. Mm-hmm. You're not going to drive a nice car, because if you do, you're going to be an arsehole, and who the heck wants to be an arsehole? Exactly. So it's a small little kind of cultural artifact and meme that actually, when you look at the root of it, it's a very limiting mindset where, and it's interesting how so many of us have got kind of negative attitudes towards the rich, the broad brush of anyone who has money, and you villainize them. But by doing so, you limit yourself from the possibility, as you say.
Absolutely. It's and really I remember as a kid, my dad, like, there was these houses that were built, wimpy houses. And, like, up until then, like, all of the houses, most of the houses in the village were council houses. Or they were, like, mansion kind of things. So it is, it's a really quirky, quaint village that just has such a different energy about it.
It's a great place to set a novel.
Aye.
As you were the whole way through, I'm like, oh, imagine that story in this place and this here and this here and this here. It'd be great.
Aye. Well, Da Vinci Code.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Go ahead, Dan Brown.
He's beat you to it. And he, so my dad would say Spam Valley. That's what he called it, Spam Valley, because the houses cost so much money that people couldn't afford to eat properly because they were paying so much for their mortgage. This was just like a wimpy house, just a like two-bedroom, three-bedroom, red brick sort of detached house. So as a kid, I had that belief of, do you know, I never think you're better than anybody else. And never, do you know, and
if you have a nice house with a mortgage, it means you're not going to have enough money to feed your family.
And,
all that sort of
and also, do you know, like my dad, never a borrower nor a lender be, do you know, and never, and it was all, do you know, like money's a real negative thing.
He
used to always say, do you know, like, his aspirations for us were for us to just get, which there's nothing wrong with, to get a job maybe like in a supermarket and work our way up. Or if we're really lucky, we could maybe be a nurse or be like an auxiliary in the hospital or something. I was never brought up to think, do you know what? You could have your own business.
Yeah.
You could actually create a job for yourself. That was never. So a lot of my limiting beliefs, and even in the run up to opening Hydroese, do you know, I was kind of going, I don't want to do this. I don't know how to do this. I'm not a businesswoman. I'm not. And even for the first wee while, I was totally like, I'm not a businesswoman. Entrepreneur. I'm not an entrepreneur. No, I just have my own business.
Yeah.
Like, I just couldn't get my head around that. And again, as you're saying, it goes back to that. But after doing the Havenin training, and really like embracing it and absolutely loving it, that was in 2006. I'd done that. In 2005 was when I'd opened Hydroese, and when I had done this business plan, and I was at that point I was working for FASA, which is the Forum for Action on Substance Abuse and Suicide Awareness, and I was their trauma and addiction worker. So I'd went from volunteering with young people leaving the care system, and I was now where I wanted to be. I was now in that position and a step closer to that profound experience in the float tank of being on a stage and all these things. Opened Hydroese in 2015 and really thought I was going to throw the doors open and the people of Northern Ireland were going to be in their swathes outside going,
do you know, Viv, I think none of us would start something if we didn't have that.
Aye.
You know, you launch a podcast, you're like, I think, even though there's like maximum 2 million people in Northern Ireland, I think 10 million people are going to listen to this.
Mm-hmm.
I think people around the world are going to be fascinated in what Belfast has to say.
Yeah.
Or my coffee shop, like, I don't think we've ordered enough cups because, like, I really think it's just going to be. But, you know, you wouldn't do it if you didn't have a bit of that in you. You need it. It's like, that's what gets you through the door.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to, like, you know, what has got you this far won't get you to the next part of the journey. You have to set that down and go on a new journey. So, no, but it is interesting.
And that's it. You have to believe it's possible.
Yeah.
And again, it's that. Do you know, I always think, you know, people talk about being hopeful and having hope, and hope's no good without possibility. You need to have possibility first. Possibility is the grandfather of hope, because you need, like, once you have possibility, once you have that what if, then it's like, do you know, what if life could get better? And this is like, I sit on a board of a charity for suicide in Northern Ireland, and it's, if you can get people to have that possibility, possibility then gives them that hope. And you know, so opened Hydroese, and I thought, you know, I'm going to go and speak to these, like, these organisations, and I'm going to, you know, there's loads of research coming out about floating and, you know, all of this stuff, and I'm going to work with people with addictions, and I'm going to do all this stuff. And so many doors got closed on my face, and not one time did I allow it to knock me back. Every single time I was just like, well, I'll try harder tomorrow. And then I got to where I was like, do you know what? I'm going to wait till they chase me. I'm just going to put my head down. I'm going to do it. And I joined, like, entrepreneur programmes, and I joined, do you know, various different things, and just kind of got myself out there, started putting myself forward for public speaking, like all of these different things. You know, won the Belfast Speech and Drama Public Speaking Award, won 3 awards, so got the coveted Rose Bowl, and done all these things, and just kind of kept my head down and kept doing. And the next thing, people were knocking at my door. Would you be interested in, you know, working with wee Johnny from down the road who's this and that? And now I'm subcontracted to Extern, which is one of the biggest charities in Northern Ireland.
Very cool.
I work with Victims and Survivors Service. I work with WAVE, the Trauma Centre. I have the Education Authority coming in next week.
Brilliant.
I've been with so many different things now are opening up, because, you know what, I've surrendered myself to the fact to, like, see if I just keep in my lane. If I just keep in my lane. And I always remember one of the best advice I was given when I first opened Hydroese was start before you're ready. Anybody that's looking at an idea that's kind of going, I wonder if I should do, like, no, I'm not, just start before you're ready. Don't wait until you've got everything in place. Don't wait till you've got your ducks in a row. Just start, because fail fast, fail often. Mm-hmm. You know, fail stands for first attempt in learning. Mm-hmm. And if you're constantly learning, if you learn to just give up the emotion, do you know what? Like, you can say to yourself, right at this moment, I feel quite sad about that. Or you can say, I am sad. I am sad is, that's me. That's yeah. my personality. That's me as a person. But
the core of who
right
I am.
Right at this moment, I'm feeling sad. It's all right to feel emotion.
Yep.
They come and they go and they come and they go.
It's the difference between, and I think this is so key, and something lit up in my brain the first time this was explained to me, the difference between I am feeling depressed and I am depressed is mountains apart.
Totally.
You know, and whenever you realize that the I, like the inner part of who you are, is safe and untouchable, but the external part of you can experience all these things. Totally. Like having that, as you would maybe in your language say, the inner child, you know, the inner child's in there and the depression doesn't have to touch it, because you can say, oh, look, it's not touching it. You know what I mean? It sounds like we're splitting atoms here, but I think, you know, you're obviously really big on language. And I think that sort of language is really important. I'm going to ask you a really random question. This is maybe a complete dead end, okay? In your therapy room upstairs at Hydroese, where you do a lot of your therapy sessions, on the wall, there's a painting with a lighthouse.
Yes.
And there's a man who's standing outside the lighthouse, and there's a huge wave like crashing over it, but he's safe because of the lighthouse. So I thought that was really interesting. And the reason why it was interesting was because I saw on your desktop, on your laptop, that your screensaver had a lighthouse on it.
Yeah.
Does that mean anything, or am I just...
No, no, it does. Yeah, so the lighthouse signifies so many different things.
Okay.
And so many people take so much from that. I mean, I remember, like, and it's interesting because that picture, that painting has been with me for... Oh, now, I bought my house in Scotland in 2006, so it's been with me for nearly 16 years.
Yeah.
And my daughter is like, Mum, see that painting? That painting is responsible for my childhood anxiety. Because I used to always look at it and think, oh my God, that poor man, that poor man.
Yeah.
For me, I look at that painting and I just think, you know, none of us know how close we are to chaos.
It's true.
Because anything can happen at any given moment. That guy simply came out and looked. So the story behind that painting, it's quite a famous painting, I can't remember the name of it, but you just Google, you know, the man in the lighthouse. And he came out and said, oh, geez, it's rough looking out there tonight. Went back in and closed the door, no knowing that that huge wave was about to come round. The guys who were working on the oil rigs had been taking pictures of the sea and taking pictures of the oil rigs, and they captured that. And they spent, I think it was like 18 months or something, looking for that guy to say, look at this picture.
Wow.
You have no... So there was a documentary made on it. But the lighthouse is just like, you know, the lighthouse is to signify land's close. It's to signify that you're almost in... at home, but it's also to signify there's danger here.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different things. It's also, do you know, a beacon of hope. There's a light that spins round. There's it's light in the dark. It's just, there's so many metaphors, for a lighthouse. And it's just something that's always just resonated with me. And do you know, it's interesting because I've been thinking about getting another tattoo.
Oh, yeah?
And in my head for a while, I've been going, do you know, a lighthouse. I think a lighthouse with something shining from it. And
interesting.
So it is, it's something. But I'd like to go back to what you said about depressed and language.
Yeah.
Even the word itself is deep rest. There is a part of us that has been strong for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And people think that depression is, oh, I'm so weak and vulnerable. And you know, people think vulnerability is a weakness.
Yeah.
Vulnerability is a superpower. If you know how to use it, if you know how to be vulnerable, and you know how to, you know, like I used to always say, everything that I've been through, these are my battle scars, and I'm going to hide them, and I never spoke about them. But they're not. They're actually my badges of honour.
Yeah.
They're my statements that say, do you know what? I survived that. And all these skeletons that I hid desperately in the closet behind me. And like, I remembered at one point in my life, you know, because I was quite well connected, you know, like getting a bag of grass and getting it really quite cheap. And my pal saying, well, could you get me some? Yeah, yeah, no problem. And her pal saying, well, could you get me some? Yeah, no problem. Well, look, why don't we just buy a big bag and then we'll share it and blah, blah. And And I remember, like, my house getting busted by the police and them saying, yeah, you're dealing drugs. And I was like, I am not a drug dealer. I am not. And I look back and I'm like, yeah, Viv, you were a drug dealer. You might have thought in my head I was doing favours for my pals and they were doing favours for their pals. But, you know, there's so many things that there comes a point where there's a part of you that's just been strong for so long that, and it's generally a young part, a very young part, you know, the wounded child or the disconnected teenager or something. There's a part that's just like, I've been trying to protect you for so long and I can't do this anymore.
Yeah.
And every now and again, we fall into that part because we ignore it and we like, shh, get away, you. I don't want to show people you. You're a really horrible side of me. People would hate me if they knew you. They would never love me. They would reject me. So I'm just going to ignore you. And then every now and again, that part goes, you think so? and just hijacks the whole system and takes ownership of every part of you. Mm. But it's just because it just needs rest. Mm. And that was just when you mentioned depressed, that I was just like that, you know, that word deep rest. Is what that is. Yeah. So anybody out there who's living with depression and who's using whatever to cope, do you know what? Do yourself a favour and get yourself a pat on the back, because every single experience you've had, you've survived. Mm-hmm. And anybody with a 100% success rate is a hero in my eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, it speaks to, in my experience with battling depression, you hear this a lot in the recovery community, and I've been in recovery for 10 years, this idea of, you know, a day at a time, and using your only real unit of measurement of time is a day.
Mm.
And I was even thinking about this when I was driving down the road today, of how, you know, if you're not having some aspect of your day that's giving you rest or bringing you joy, let's say you're making a big sacrifice because you're in a busy season with work, or, you know, you've got this goal and you want to reach this goal and da-da-da-da-da. You know, your life is an accumulation of days and you need to make sure that you're giving yourself that deep rest opportunity, even in your daily life, because it's so easy to, you know, and maybe for a day it's fine, but then you're doing 3 months of it, or then you're doing 6 months of it. Mm-hmm. And then there's that switch that you're talking about where all of a sudden your body's throwing the hand up and saying, you know, as Gabor would say, when the body says no.
Mm-hmm. And exactly what happened to me in 1999.
Yeah.
My body was just like, we're not doing this anymore. We cannot sustain this.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is. It's just we become, and the world's so frenetic. Like, you've got to remember that our bodies and our minds haven't evolved any further than they did. Mm-hmm. Like, the last part, I think, of us to evolve was hundreds of thousands of years ago, and it was the prefrontal cortex. It was the part of the, you know, that kind of brought us right up into the sort of man, like, woman mankind that we are now. We've not evolved any further.
Yeah.
But our lifestyles have changed. Even in my lifetime, you know, I find myself saying, and I remember my grand saying, do you know, I worry for the young. Do you know, and I've said that at least.
I say days, that, you know, and I'm 26.
Aye.
We have, like, among my peers and inner circle, like, a lot of our, like, burdened conversation is, I just can't imagine what it's like for the 12-year-old today.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 14 years between us.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And, like, my oldest is 32 this year. And we were sitting chatting the other night there, and he was saying, do you know, Mum, I am so glad I grew up when I was born when I did. He said, because I've got a wee boy who's 9 as well. He said, I would hate to grow up in Sonny's era. Mm. He was like, it's so frenetic. And you know, a lot of the children now have all these labels of ADHD and autism and all these different things. It's like, well, here's a crazy idea. How about they're just being nurtured in a world that's gone completely ballistic?
Yeah, but that word frenetic is so important.
Oh.
Like, you think about, like, I don't know, I'll make this quick, but say a 9-year-old 100 years ago, they probably had like 8 hours of the day where they did the same thing. And it was either playing outside and being in nature, or it was working in a factory, right? Yep. And now it's like you're doing 40 different things in that 8-hour window, and your attention is constantly being splintered and splintered and fragmented and fragmented. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the day, you're looking at yourself, you're like, why do I feel like I'm in pieces? You're like, because you literally are.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And even, you know, when you look at, you know, one of my friends came up with this thing about double screening. you know, like, oh, young people now are double screening. And I said, what do you mean by that? She was like, well, generally they'll be playing a computer, but they'll be watching the iPad. And I was like,
so true.
It's true. Like, my wee boy will sit and he'll have the iPad and he'll have the TV on. Yeah. Or he'll be upstairs playing a game and he's got, you know, he's got like something else on. Or for his Christmas, I got him a drum kit. And I was like, right, you can play your computer games if you spend some time in the drum kit. And he's got a saxophone and he's got Tibetan singing bowls. And I'm like, well, you have to spend some time with that stuff to spend some time with this. And it's just, you know, to start with, he's about like, right, I'll have 5-10 minutes. And then he's like, listen to this, Mum. The singing bowls. And then I've got like a rainmaker and out. And he's like, oh. The next thing, it's like an hour or something.
Yeah.
And he's just spent that time in the moment without any kind of technology. Yeah, he's got sound and there's new stimulation.
But that's the flow state you were talking about earlier as well, which is so important. And we have a wee, like a year and a half year old, so we're very, very new on the journey. But, you know, just being exposed to things we've never heard of before, this idea that, like, you know, when children are playing, they're really working and you shouldn't interrupt kids when they're really deep in that play state, because it would be like someone coming into my office and barging in when I'm in the middle of a deep edit or something. Yeah. And how it's so important to give kids that deep time, and even for ourselves, that deep work, you know, where there isn't any distractions, there is no interruptions, because something interesting is really happening in your brain. I feel like we could go on for about 4 hours all down the different rabbit holes. So I'm going to slowly start to like start the process of like closing some of the loops. Okay. So first loop I want to close is, how did you get sober? Like, was that before you went to China? Or what did the kind of, I will never use the term the end of that journey, but the kind of pinnacle moment of that journey. What would that, how did that all play out?
So for me, so I've got Sonny who's 9.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years ago when I fell pregnant with Sonny, at that point I had really reduced so many things. I had reduced, you know, I wasn't using cocaine really at all, like maybe once a month or something, once every couple of months.
Oh, by the way, I've got a guy to do your tattoo. I just had him in. His name's Willie G. He used to be a cocaine addict and he's got an amazing story and you would get on like a house on fire. But I'll talk to you afterwards. I need to make a wee note. Okay.
Yep. So I, you know, really, really reduced over time. The better the relationship I grew with myself, the more I accepted and made peace with each and every part of me, the more I kind of said, do you know what? That was my experience and here's what I've learned, and started to reduce and reduce and reduce. So for 10 years, I haven't taken, like I haven't, you know, taken any drugs. I haven't really, that now I've just, depending how you look at it, I suppose. Last year I done plant medicine.
Yeah.
So, you know, psychedelics, Cambo, Bufo, like lots of different things. So I'm not going to say I never took drugs, because a drug is anything that alters your state.
Yeah.
Do you know, and I had a cake like earlier and I had sugar in it.
In fairness, like the psychedelic and prickly things like ayahuasca, as they're coming more and more in popularity, the recovery community hasn't really made up their mind yet.
Yeah.
Does that break your sobriety, or is this something different? The same way if you went in the hospital and they give you like some sort of medication, you know, could you then go back? Well, technically that's a drug, so like you're actually not sober because like you had morphine after that surgery, you know what I mean? So,
and
like,
that really depends on where you're at inside your own head.
And I think it's drug of choice.
And
you know?
Like, I'm the regional coordinator for Northern Ireland for SMART, which is the like an alternative to AA. AA is a 12-step program, and it's quite... it's quite a lot of sort of religious context and stuff in it.
Oh, like, it's incredibly spiritual and it's incredibly cultish. And that's why it can be really successful for people. Yeah. There's no problem saying that. No one will be offended.
No.
Everyone I know in AA is like, their eyes are wide open, you know?
Where SMART's very much about, do you know what? You maybe never got up one day and says, do you know what? I am going to be addicted to whatever.
Sure.
I'm going to trash my family. I'm going to, you know, do this or do that. I'm going to totally ruin my life. Nobody makes that decision. But at some point in life, 8 years old behind a couch, that decision, this works. That decision led to other decisions, which led to other decisions, which led to other decisions. So I'm a firm believer in, see, for some people, abstinence is the only way.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely the only way. For other people, so like myself, it's about understanding your behaviour and why you used, mm-hmm. What was it you were doing? What were you avoiding? What were you doing? So I still drink. I would still drink. I would still, do you know, if I'm out, I'll have a few gins. If I, mm-hmm. like, do you know, at Christmas, I had Prosecco, I had cocktails, I had, do you know, I'll go to friends' houses and stuff. But it's not something that I use to avoid. It's not something that I mm-hmm. use to distract. It's not something that I use as a coping strategy.
It's more of the state of mind that it's you have more, while you use is really key.
It's more that it's become a social thing now for me. Mm-hmm. And, do you know, as I say, I don't smoke the hash anymore. I don't take anything really. I take, you know, vitamins every day. I take, you know, various different things like that.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that I've actually got sober.
Sure.
Or, well, I'm clean because I've not used any drugs at all. I have stopped that side of it.
Yeah.
But it's when something no longer controls you. Mm. So it's not like every single, it's not like I'm going out and saying, no, I can't go to the pub because I don't drink. And I don't really want to be around people that are drunk. And I don't want to be, because I can be in a pub.
Yeah.
I can have a couple of drinks. But I can also choose, nah, not tonight.
Yeah.
I can also choose, do you know what? I'm just going to sit and have coffee tonight. I can sit in a bar and, do you know, be the driver. Mm-hmm. I can sit, but equally I can go out and be like, I'm going to have a great night tonight. I'm going to have a few drinks. I'm going to be up on that dance floor. Because I have personal autonomy.
Yeah.
I have personal power. I'm able to make decisions in that moment that are not based on what I can and can't do. Because mm-hmm. the minute you tell yourself you cannot do something, there's a part of you goes, oh, I really want to do that.
Yeah.
I really want to do that.
Yeah.
And if you're constantly going, I'm not going to drink. It's like saying, don't think about pink elephants.
Yeah.
Whatever you do not think about pink
Classic.
Elephants. All you're thinking about is pink elephants.
Yeah.
So
there's that belief. I don't know if it's a Buddhist thing, but whatever you resist persists.
Exactly.
All that sort of mm-hmm. stuff I always find very interesting. Mm-hmm. Oh, here in your office as well, there's the list of like, there's like 10 Zen things or something like that. That's what I was thinking about whenever I was talking, you were talking about Sonny playing the drums and my daughter playing. It's like, it said something like, do one thing. You know, and I was like, how often in our lives do we just do one thing? Mm-hmm. And it's part of the reason why podcasting has become part of one of my drugs of choice now is because it's one of the few things in my life that I do that is just one thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very, very, you're locked in, you know, it's interesting.
And the best part about that poster is when Buddha was asked, what have you gained from meditation? And his answer was nothing. But let me tell you what I've lost. Anxiety, fear, need for control, like all of these things. So he's went through, you know, I'm not doing it to get anything.
Yeah.
I'm doing it to just surrender.
Yeah.
And I think so many of us struggle and fight and we have this internal conflict where if we just surrender and just be like, and again, that comes down to vulnerability.
Yeah.
Comes down to, you know, Brené Brown's book, Daring Greatly. And she talks about, you know, the person who's willing to stand and step into the arena and really make themselves seen for who they really are. And Gabor talks about, you know, we trade authenticity for connection.
Mm-hmm.
So we step out of our truth because we think, oh no, I better not say that. They might not like it.
Mm-hmm.
And that minute that we have that freedom to be like, no, this is what I think. And if someone goes, what you're talking about, shit, you know, well, you know, that's my perception.
Yeah.
Because that's the one thing we all have that's unique to us.
Mm-hmm.
It's our perception. And we tell ourselves so many stories about things in our head.
Yeah.
Somebody will say or do something in your head. You're like, do you know what they're doing? Like, classic example. My daughter, 10 years old, living in Scotland, comes in from school, runs in the door. It's me, Mum. Drops her bag at the bottom of the stairs, drops her jacket halfway up the stairs, runs into her bedroom, takes off her school uniform, gets herself dressed to go out with her friends, grabs her football on the way out the door and walks back out again. And I'm like, be back for your tea at 5. And as she's walking, yeah, see you later, Mum. And then I walk into the hall and I'm like, she's left her bag there.
Yeah.
She thinks I'm a bloody slave. I'll tell you when she comes back. So I'm picking up the stuff as I'm in my head saying, that's because she just uses me. That's because she thinks I've nothing better to do with my time. That's what... She's 10 years old.
Yeah.
She's not walked in that house and went, I'll leave that there for the skivvy.
Yeah, and then I'll just decide.
She's in her
intentionally,
head
going, let me see, should it be 8 steps up or 10 steps up? What would annoy her the most, do you think?
Exactly. But the story inside my head is all of the stuff that I'm telling myself.
Yeah.
And the minute we catch ourselves on and say, that's an interesting story. And you know what? I give it permission to be there,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not living my life by it anymore.
Yeah. When you talked about stepping out of authenticity for the sake of connection, there's a joke me and some of my buddies repeat quite a lot around like the holidays. And I think it was like a tweet somebody put up and it screenshotted and it's done the round in our groups. And it said something like, you can tell how far along you are in your healing journey or how well you've dealt with your trauma if you can spend 2 weeks in your family of origin without becoming a six-year-old again. And I think so often, again, it's rife in Northern Ireland, people find it really hard to kind of be themselves with their family. And there's like a splitting of the personality where it's like, this is who I am with my friends and this is the real me, but then I have to kind of revert to this other thing inside the family dynamic. So I literally just say that to put it on people's radar if you're listening, as a jumping off point to maybe go and explore that a little bit further.
But you know what's really scary about that for people, Matt, is when we make change and when we step into who we are and, you know, when we change, we think people around about us change. When we change, we think we're the only person that changes. But other people struggle. So a family who's used to you being who you are.
Yeah.
Like, I've just went through something recently. And, you know, my family are like, oh, well, the old Viv wouldn't have put up with that. Yeah. She would have been right in there with the fists. And, and I'm like, it's been 20 years since I've been fighting. Do you know what I mean? Goodness sake. Like, but for them, they've used stereotype because their patterns and their programs, they're comparing and contrasting what's happened previous to what happens now. Mm-hmm. So for some people, they'll maybe go to a family wedding and then they're like, no, I'm not going because Uncle Bob will be there. And every time Uncle Bob's there, he gets pissed and he just this and that and blah, blah, blah. Uncle Bob made an idiot of himself at one family wedding. Yeah. And people are like, no, he's a drunk and he's this and that. Mm-hmm. And Uncle Bob's been sober for the last 10 years. But so people still just have it in their head because it's familiar for them, because they're deleting, they're distorting and they're generalizing in a way that's right for them, that's a pattern. And when we stop and kind of go, do you know what? Am I limiting myself because of what's actually happening here in the reality? Or am I being served by the programs of the past, by the patterns of the past, by the stories that are repeating themselves inside my head? And, you know, one of my sort of key messages when I'm doing public speaking is, you're not your story. Yeah. You are who you choose to become. If I decided to be my story, I'd still be in that tiny wee village in Scotland. I'd probably be married to somebody that lived around the corner from me. And again, there's nothing wrong in that. And I would be, you know, and I would still be that small person. And I remember, you know, I was home recently and meeting up with this guy that I hadn't even seen for about 15 years easy. I'd seen him in a bar and he said, you know, I can't believe what you've done with your life. I always just thought you were just this wee girl. You know, you were always just you were just a small time girl and you were just going to be like, party animal that everybody went to their house for a party and blah blah. And I just thought, wow, like people who, I mean, like he was a friend but he wasn't a close friend. And I thought, do you know, even people on the periphery of my life have stereotyped me without actually really knowing who I am. So no wonder it's easy for your family, your direct family, to do it, because they grew up with you. They know that you were the one that went, well, I'm not doing that. Who stomped your feet? Who pulled your brother's hair? Who did it? So, and people still judge you on that stuff.
Yeah.
Because it's easy for them.
It's true. I really love the idea of self-signaling as well. The example that was given to me was someone's walking down the street and they're smoking. And maybe you'll have the attitude of like, oh, I can't believe they're smoking. Like, can't believe that they, let's say, are so careless with their health and they're going to have this, they're going to have that. And you can have all these kind of negative things. But then the same thing happens if you start smoking. That belief will also attack you, yourself, even though you're the one that's doing it. And I think that ties in somewhat with what you just said there as well. Yeah. It's good to look out for too.
And you know, like even me mentioning that, there's, and this happens a lot with people who are same-sex orientated, especially if they've grew up in a family where the belief is that a family is a man and a woman and a child, or it's like that's what's accepted, or a Christian belief where that is what the family unit is. And then you hit 10, 11, 9, whatever, when you have your sexual awakening and you're like, oh, I'm actually attracted to the same sex as me. And you tell your mum and dad and your brothers and sisters and your granny and granddad, and everybody's like, we still love you as you are.
Yeah.
But your subconscious mind's gone, but that's wrong.
Interesting.
That's wrong because, you know, a unit as a man and woman, because that's what you've been taught.
Yeah.
So the values, the beliefs, the attitudes, the memories and the decisions that we have before age 7 stay with us for such a long time. Because at that point, we do not have the cognitive capacity to challenge them. We accept it. Blind belief. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because we don't have the critical faculty barrier. And that's the bit of the brain that starts to develop that tells us that's right, that's wrong, that's good, that's bad, that's mm-hmm. safe, that's dangerous, that's truth, that's lies. And we start to be able to analyse information. We also start to go, I'm separate from my mum and dad.
Yeah.
So everything that's kind of packed in before then, we very rarely challenge. And this can cause a huge issue for people. As I say, at that point, and I just picked people that are same-sex orientated because it's such a good example of that.
Example.
So
yeah.
People have this internal homophobe. Everybody around them's fine with it.
Yeah.
There's just something inside them going, oh, Jesus, you're like, that's not supposed to happen. That's not. And it can be really
crazy?
Debilitating for people.
Wow.
Do you know, where they're like, do you know, everybody's dead happy for me and I'm out. And like, this should be the happiest time of my life. But, and they don't know what it is.
Yeah.
And it's because there's, as I say, there's that wee bit in them that's causing that judgment. And like, we're our own worst critics. Mm. Like, nobody will judge us. If you sat in a cafe and sat with you and your internal critic, I've made good friends of mine now, so we're good. But in general, you would be like, for goodness sake, like,
yeah.
Give that guy a break. Why are you speaking to him like that?
Yeah.
Why are you allowing yourself to be spoken to like that?
Mm-hmm.
But we never see these as separate entities inside us. We never see these. And when we split these parts and look at, you know, I can see the role.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why I developed that part of me. I can see why I developed that part of me. I can see why that part cannot stand that part.
Mm-hmm.
I can see why that part gets on so well with that part. Because, and when we start to look at ourselves as that, do you know, then we create a whole, we step into our essence, we step into our truth. And when we have the confidence and the belief in ourselves to kind of voice what it is that we're thinking in a way that's respectful, in a way that's, in a way that's authentic to us,
mm-hmm.
then things massively change for us, even yep. in terms of the people that we draw around us.
Totally. Two more things. Ready? It's too big. We should have spent more time on this, so it's my bad. Whatever you have to say about floating.
Right, so a quick rundown of flotation. Flotation. Developed in the mental health labs in Virginia in the 1950s by Dr. John C. Lilly. John C. Lilly, it was on the back of the war, and there was a huge interest in, what are they called? Tactics for...
Cybernetic.
Yeah, but like, you know, when you're persecuting someone, what's it called again? Anyway, they had been doing deprivation. They'd been doing light deprivation, food deprivation, all these different things. And John C. Lilly came up with this question. What happens when you completely deprive the senses of any kind of external input?
Mm.
Does the mind just close off?
Yeah.
Do you go into deep sleep? Or do you go off somewhere else? And there was a huge question around consciousness at this point as well. And there was loads of, you know, there was loads of Buddhist teachings. There was loads of, research coming about psychedelics and various things like that. So he was like, right, I'm going to try this. And it started off as these almost like space suits that people were submerged in water. And they were in there for 8 hours. So the human psyche went through the whole, right, I'm bored now, right, I'm bored now, right into the whole delving into the sexuality, delving into the fears, delving into the euphoric, delving into all this stuff. So that was in the 1950s. It started to gain huge popularity. And then in the 80s, AIDS hit. And when AIDS hit, anything that involved communal water was massively impacted.
Mm-hmm.
And floating just disappeared because it was quite new to the market as it was. And it became quite a sort of underworld cult thing.
Yeah.
And it was used by quite a lot of, you know, the sort of hippie communities.
Sure.
Had a huge resurgence in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then float centres started popping up all over the States and then popping up all over the world. So 25 centimetres of body temperature water. Half a ton of Epsom salt.
Half a ton. That has been the thing that, aside from my own experience in the tank, that's the thing I've been telling people. It's like, there's 500 kilos of salt in this small little bit of water.
That's it. So it makes a really unique concept because it looks like water, it feels like water, but it's actually a solid, hence why you can lie on top of it.
Mm.
But that minute you lie back and you're held and supported by the environment. And I heard, when you were talking about it in the last podcast, I heard Scott saying that it's body temperature. It's actually skin temperature because the body temperature cools slightly as it comes to the top. So, and the air we have, so it's a controlled environment. The air, the water, and your skin is all the same sort of same temperature. So what happens then is the subconscious mind goes, "Hang on, am I standing up? Am I sitting down? Am I lying on my back? Like where's the world got?
Yeah.
Hang on, where's all this information that's coming in? Why can't I see, hear, feel, smell, taste? Pretty much nothing." And then what happens is that, because we spend 80% of our energy fighting things like movement and balance and keeping ourselves, you know, going wherever it is that we're going, and then we spend a lot of energy deleting, distorting and generalising all of that information that's coming in, then all of a sudden, no need for any of it.
Wow.
So that 80% of energy turns inwards, which activates the blood flow, stimulates the lymphatic and the digestive system. So it starts a full body detox. So for addictions, it's brilliant because it allows any substance that you've been using, you know, whether it's sugar, whether it's cocaine, whether it's alcohol, whatever that is, it allows it to just be processed through that whole system and detoxed out the body really quickly. There's emerging research in relation to the transdermal effects of the magnesium. So magnesium sulfate reduces swelling, improves the function of the immune system. You know, there's something like over 300 enzyme functions from magnesium. So the transdermal effects of that, when you reduce the stimulation coming in through the mind, what happens is what we're finding through fMRI and EEG scans is that it reduces activity in the fight or flight, in the amygdala. In fact, it reduces activity in that whole part of the brain called salient mode network, which is like the limbic system, the emotion centres, the moods, the and then that threat centre. But what it also does is it starts to increase activity in the right constructs of the brain. So your creative thought process, your abstract kind of thinking, your love of music and colours and shapes, and your real kind of, you know, pictorial sort of visions and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So while you're lying there, you're supported and suspended. You are held in almost like a safety. Your mind's going off and away and doing something. Your body then goes, right, well, with this energy, let's
do some spring cleaning.
That old rugby wound that you have from 5 years ago, let's go and fix that in your knee. Or, do you know that really tight, tense feeling you have across your shoulders? Let's go and just release the lactic acid in there. Mm-hmm. So it's really good for things like fibromyalgia, for arthritis, but also for things like sports injuries, pregnancy, anything that's a heaviness on the body, anything that's a tightness, or it's just the most amazing thing. Not just that, like, we are supposed to have periods of darkness. Like, we're supposed to live by the sun and the moon.
So true.
Like, and again, going back to, our bodies haven't evolved any further.
Ancient brains, ancient bodies, modern times.
Aye. Yeah. And we need to have that time where, like, the biggest cortex in the brain is the visual cortex. And it's right across the back here. And it's stimulated all the time. Even if you're in deep meditation and you're in a darkened room, if you open your eyes a bit, you'll start to see the white curtains, or you'll start to see the window frame, or you'll start to see the light chinking through the door, or it's dark in the tank, like dark.
Yeah.
And our tanks, because when I first opened Hydroease, I was like, what were the things that almost stopped me from getting in the tank that day? The first thing was, it was like a coffin.
So that's interesting, because like, I don't know what I was expecting, but I wasn't expecting it to look like what it does.
Yeah.
It really took me by surprise, actually. And it was very comfortable.
Mm-hmm. So I was like, so I got a guy, I got a company in England, and they made these tanks that are big enough for two people. It's like a, as you know, it's like a porter cabin.
Yeah.
And it's two doors that you open. It's not a lid that you open and close on yourself.
It's more like stepping into a really big shower cubicle.
Yep. That's exactly it. So I was like, right, that takes away that barrier. I want it big enough for two people. So if someone says, oh, I don't know, I'm a bit claustrophobic, it's fine. It's 6 feet. 6 feet by 8 feet and 7 feet in height. I don't know if I'd like to do it myself. Absolutely fine. It's big enough for two people. You can bring someone with you. Oh, I don't know if I'd like the dark. I'm not really. Absolutely fine. We've got colour therapy in there. You can have colour when you're on. Oh, I don't know if I'd like the silence. You know, on my own with my thoughts. Absolutely fine. We have speakers under the water. You can listen to music.
Mm-hmm.
So every barrier that somebody has cut that you're could come along with, I was just like, because I understand flotation from a mental health perspective. I understand flotation as an antidote to modern life.
Wow.
Like, we're not supposed to live the way we live. Mm-hmm. And I just find that, and you know, our tagline is the magic is within you, because everything we need to get to where we want to be, to have what we want to have, to achieve what we want to achieve is within this skin. Mm-hmm. It's from the skin in. And we can make it happen if we can dream it. The most powerful nation in the world is the imagination. Mm-hmm. And see, given half a chance, allowing no need for movement, no need for balance, nothing, see, hear, feel, smell, taste, the imagination's like,
yeah,
let's do this. And as I say, that's why my experience was so profound, because I was able to clear the way for my imagination to go, what if?
Yeah.
What if you could do this? What if you could be this person? And it just offered me something that, and when people come in, see if people come in and they go, I just didn't get it. I'm like, get out. Get out. But I love it when people come out and they're just like, oh my God. I'm like, I know.
Yeah.
I know. And I'm so excited for them, because it's just that opportunity to just be. Like, the clues in the title were human beings. But over the last 40, 50 years, we've become human doings.
Yep.
We're always doing something, doing this, doing that, being here. But like, it's just gives you an hour to just, and as you know, there's no time, mm-hmm. there's no space, there's nothing in the float tank. Like, none of that matters. None of it's important.
Yeah. I think what I said to Scott that day was, I kind of felt like I just was going back to my family after like a 2 weeks, like, space exploration trip. You know what I mean? Like, your concept of time was just so different. But I'm really interested in that idea of, like, slowing down time, mm-hmm. and, like, how good it feels for your body and for your brain. And I think, like, the float tank experience for me was, and the reason why I will be back is, this is something that somewhat resets me.
Absolutely.
You know? And if you can even like, a very lazy kind of, I'm all into, like, regular routines, and then, you know, if you can't do daily, well, then do weekly. If you can't do weekly, do monthly. If you can't do monthly, then do quarterly. If you can't do quarterly, then do yearly. But even if something to do like once a quarter for me, I can really see the benefit of it.
And do you know, in the float tank, in the space of an hour, you're suspended in theta state, which is your natural learning and consolidation state. And it's the state just before you go to sleep where you're not quite sleeping, but you're not awake, and you're in that dreamy, really. Do you know, and then the dog barks and you're like, so it takes you into theta state. In that state, your brain will produce the same endorphins in the space of 1 hour as it would in about between 4 and 6 hours sleep.
Crazy.
So that's your body's natural painkiller and your body's natural feel-good chemical. So when I work with people in a one-to-one and I'm using havening and cognitive behavioral therapy and neuro-linguistic programming and compassionate inquiry and brain spotting and doing all of this stuff and working with brainwave states, and then put somebody in a float tank where their brain comes up into that learning and consolidation state where their mind and their body goes, what does that actually mean to me? And that person gets an opportunity to become their own therapist. Like, I firmly believe nobody is going to know your body and mind like you do.
Sure.
And you know, you can be the best therapist, either like massage, reflexology, Reiki, or you can be like the best like counselor, CBT, whatever. We're never going to get it right for everybody, because there's no way you can study every single model theory. There's no way you could study under every single teacher, listen to every podcast, read every book. But you do. So in the float tank, it's you using your knowledge of you to heal and mend and shift and change and all these different things. So is that then you just, it's just, it just improves that relationship with yourself. And for some people, it actually activates that relationship in the first place, like it did with me. As I say, it was like that bit that had went off and was like, your body, that's far too dangerous a place for
The
spiritual element, the essence of me was like, we're not hanging about here.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I got in the float tank, it was like, aha, we're back and you've got work to do.
Yeah.
And do you know, if like, everybody should float.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you know what? I was going to add something. I'll share it with you off mic, because I actually think that that's the best place to end.
Happy days.
So, Vivian,
thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for your time and for the amazing adventure that we've been on over the last hour or so. So, yeah, really appreciate it. If you've been touched by what you've heard today, I really encourage you just to sit with that and not just push it away and not just rush on to the next part of your day, or, you know, tap the next podcast to listen to. But I think after experiences like this, that you kind of have a bit of an opportunity to do something. And I don't know, I just want to underscore what Vivian said about possibility and how there is immense possibility to do something here. And so whether you've been touched by this conversation or any of the other conversations as part of this series, it's only you that can take action and can move forward. And so we just really hope and urge you to do so. So yeah, thanks for being here, and I will catch you next time.